The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good morning. My name's Bok Shu, and today I'm continuing my series of talks on the four vows, or more formally, we know them as the four bodhisattva vows, or in Japanese, the Shigu Seigan Man. The fourth of the four vows is my subject today. In Japanese, it reads, Butsu do mujo seiganjo. If you type Butsu do mujo seiganjo into Google Translate, you get, if you have any questions. And if you take out the space between any two words, the translation becomes New Year's Eve. If you put a slash between the two last words, it translates to cancer. Doesn't this underscore the inadequacy of words? My using words to talk about the Dharma is pitiful and offensive, but I have no choice. Do I? If I'm to give a Dharma talk. According to Robert Aitken, the literal translation of the fourth vow is Buddha way, no top, pledge, vow, become. So I've been giving you these little word-by-word translations throughout this series, and I'll now give them all to you, all of the literal translations of the four vows. The many beings, no limit, pledge, vow, carry a cross. Grief, distress, no exhausting. Pledge, vow, conclude. Dharma gates, no measure. Pledge, vow, learn. Buddha way, no top. Pledge, vow, become. No limit, no exhausting, no measure, no top. I think we could just say that and be done with it. But at the Village Zendo, we say it differently. We say, the Buddha way is unattainable. I vow to attain it. So there's some fancy dancing for you. The Buddha way is unattainable. I vow to attain it. So the first thing we might notice in this vow is the apparent contradiction. If the Buddha way is unattainable, why vow to attain it? Sounds self-defeating, doesn't it? A waste of time. Encountering what seems to be a contradiction, I ask why. My reflex is to try to contain and subdue mystery and ambiguity with logic and analysis. I invoke why to contain something that doesn't fit my preconceived notions, to end my suffering. And that's the purpose of why for me, is just to end my suffering. But in asking why, I only compound my folly and increase my suffering, something I do lots of every day. So we're challenged by this fourth vow to do something that the vow itself says can't be done. We start by asking why, and then we try to understand the vow by theorizing along these lines. Okay, so this means we've already attained the Buddha way, and therefore there's no attaining. I've got it. I don't have to attain it. That's one theory. Another is, the Buddha way is unattainable, but my vow is so strong that it doesn't matter. My vow is terrific, and that's all that matters. So it's okay that it's unattainable, because I've got my vow. And then the third interpretation might be, and there are probably many more, but the one that I could come up with was that the Buddha way is the heritage of us all. And how can the heritage of us all be the attainment of just one? So these wild speculations take us only further from what this vow is about. And that's the problem with words. They're barriers we use to create even bigger barriers, which we call concepts. On top of that, we think we know what words mean. What these barriers are, we think we know what words mean. Right now, I'm using words to say that we do not know what words mean. Do you know what I mean? Do I know what I mean? Definitely not. One of the most basic words in the English language is the word I. Do we share a common understanding of that word and what it means? Used as a pronoun, I means me individually, as distinguished from you individually and collectively. The most basic unit of our language, the letter I, encapsulates our confusion about reality, the fundamental error that we're always making of distinguishing the I from the you, the us from the them. It's built into our language at the most basic level, this level of separation that we impose on reality. It's strange that we think this way. We take it as normal, but it doesn't have to be normal. Everyone is an I. And because everyone is an I is collective. It is collective and individual at once. And as you say the four vows and vow with the letter I to attain the Buddha way, you might remember that you are not just vowing with your individual I, but that you are vowing with the I of everyone else who has ever made that vow and not made that vow, just as importantly. It's not a club, and we're not members of some high and mighty group that knows the way and others don't. The way is open to all and is being trod by all right now. To engage in this endeavor of the Buddha way is to examine and overturn the fundamental misunderstandings embedded in our words. Non-separation is the basis of this practice. To embrace and to be embraced by the whole, to realize the intimate connection that's always there and that will always be there. Non-separation is the way. And so it's very helpful for my talk that I'm very good at separating. Recently, I was waiting for a subway at a station in Brooklyn. The train pulled into the station, the doors open, and right in front of me was a woman sitting in a wheelchair. And I noticed at that moment that I recoiled, that I was somehow put off, that I felt uncomfortable and did not want to go into that particular part of the subway car. I wanted to escape, but noticing my anxiety, I stepped into the subway car as a normal person might. I didn't separate from my desire to separate. My way, my Buddha way, is to study my need to separate and to explore the boundaries of that need to separate relentlessly, deeply, and compassionately. So, what was my problem with this woman in a wheelchair? What was so terrifying to me about her? Was it that she might need help? Was it that she might need information, protection, money? Even if that were the case, what was so scary about that, if she needed any of those things? It's as if I couldn't distinguish between vulnerability and dependency. It's as if I couldn't discern the difference between sharing a space with someone and making myself responsible for that person. It's as if by sharing the space with her, I was ceding my free will, my agency. Like walking in and standing next to her was some kind of contractual arrangement binding me to do whatever it was that I feared I might need to do for her. So without one iota of information, I constructed in less than a second this whole mythology of what this woman might need and how I might be called upon to provide it. It sounds ridiculous, but how precious to be able to witness how our minds work as our minds are working in the moment, to be able to both have these crazy thoughts, to identify what they are, to name them, and to just kind of reflect on them all at once in real time. It's an amazing gift that we can give ourselves. And this activity that we've engaged in this morning, Zazen, is the way to give it to ourselves. This is the way we train our minds to observe our minds as they function. And it's incredibly valuable because moment by moment, our lives are happening. And if you want your life, participate in it as fully and deeply and on as many levels as you possibly can. And that's what Zazen is training us to do. So don't let anyone tell you that Zazen's good for nothing. It's a nice thought. I like the phrase, and I love Kodo Sawaki, but it really can help us to appreciate our lives. So not being separate from another person does not automatically translate into our being responsible for the other person. It does not mean that we need to intervene in their situation just to medicate ourselves and allay our own anxiety. We are always free to make a choice. And it does not have to be the choice that our fantasies tell us is the choice of a nice person. When our brains turn physical proximity into a sense of obligation, the way my brain did at this particular time, then it's high time to re-examine our notions of individual and collective responsibility. We think we know what helping is. We think we understand the situation, the needs, the history, and the preferences of the other seemingly less capable person. Are they less capable really? Are we obligated to help, really? In advance of the moment when action is possible, we're just indulging our fantasies. And our fantasies are just our habits. When I first came to this place 12 years ago, I thought I needed help. I thought meditation would be helpful to me. A reasonable supposition, but I had no idea what help I thought I needed and what help would look like. I had no idea how my direct experience of myself through meditation, through community, would be helpful. Has it helped? Can anyone here certify that it has or that it hasn't helped me? Can anyone here help me now? Help me with my loneliness, my sense of inadequacy, my suffering? Don't think that just because you're a teacher, you don't feel inadequate. On the contrary, there's nothing like being in a position of authority to activate one's insecurities. It's a great teaching. Let me tell you, action happens now. There is no other time, no other place, no other person There is no such thing as helping or ignoring or pretending to be good. When we stop groveling before our own ideas of how we should be, we are on the Buddha way. Or when we watch ourselves groveling before our own ideas about how we should be, we are on the Buddha way. We can lose our ideas about who we are, about what we are. We can be free to think about how we might be without our ideas of who and what we are. Is there anything to attain in that? Is there any attaining going on right now? The point is to see how it is for us to be in the world, to pay meticulous attention to whatever is right in front of us, and how we see it and how we don't see it. And then to work actively with what we harvest with our attention, to become more aware, more skillful and free. This is the Buddha way. The fourth vow reads, "The Buddha way is unattainable. I vow to attain it." So what is vowing to attain it? When Shakyamuni Buddha glimpsed the morning star, the legend says that he declared, "I and the great earth and beings simultaneously attain the way." Is there a difference between Shakyamuni's I and your I? In fact, Shakyamuni could have just said, "I attain the way," and it would have not meant anything different. What about the act of vowing itself? If you see vow as an obligation, you're not on the Buddha way. If you compel yourself to act in a certain way as a manifestation of your vow, you are way off track. A vow is a question that we can live wholeheartedly. It's not an act we put on, and it's not something to bind ourselves with. As I rode the subway with the woman in the wheelchair, the train pulled into a station and a lot of people piled on. One of the people who crowded in grabbed the pole, and on her arm she had a bag. And as the train moved, she was talking to her companions, and wouldn't you know it, but the bag landed pretty much right in the lap of the woman in the wheelchair. And she didn't notice it, and strange to tell, the woman in the wheelchair didn't seem to notice, or perhaps she didn't care, or perhaps it happened so many times, she was just too damn tired to make the effort to say anything about it. But something inside my head said that this was not right. A person in a wheelchair is not a piece of furniture on a subway car, no matter how crowded that car becomes. So I kind of gestured to the woman with the bag on her arm and made her understand what was going on. And as soon as she recognized what was happening, she moved her arm in the bag. Problem solved. Did I do something good? Or did I insert myself in the situation where I didn't belong? Does anyone here know? In that moment, I took an action that seemed appropriate. There is no one in the entire world who could tell me whether that action was right or wrong. In any case, it was no big deal. When Arya Simha met Hakla Nyashas, Arya Simha said, "I want to see the way. What concerns should I have?" Hakla Nyashas, "If you want to seek the way, there is nothing to be concerned about." Arya Simha, "If I have no concerns, who carries out Buddha activities?" Hakla Nyashas, "If you have some business, these are not merits. If you do nothing, this is the Buddha way." Now let's return to this business of attaining the unattainable Buddha way. Let's say you're drinking tea, and as you drink the liquid, a tea leaf comes out of the cup and into your mouth, and you swallow it. Is the tea leaf separate from the tea? The tea leaf will make its way into your colon. The tea will make its way into your bladder. You may shit the leaf and piss the tea at the same time, sequentially, or at entirely different times. Leaf and liquid went down your throat and ultimately leave your body as waste. Did you attain any of it? You cannot get tea without tea leaves. Are they one or two? What is their relationship with the cup, and how do they relate to your body? Leaves ultimately spring from your asshole. The tea leaves your genitals. At precisely what moment do you attain the tea? This year there was an abundant rain in the southwestern deserts in California after a severe and prolonged drought. The rain unleashed a lush profusion of flowers and growth. That was quite magnificent, apparently. I wish I'd seen it. And all that growth was there already, waiting to happen, waiting to express itself. And yet, because of the summer heat, all the flowers and the plants have died and dried up. So now there's a concern that tremendous fires will occur because of all this newly dried brush, highly combustible and created by unusually wet conditions. Did the desert attain that moisture and then lose it all? The lifeless desert is teeming with the reality of life. The living desert is teeming with the inevitability of an inferno. The desert has not stopped blooming or burning for even a single moment. Sitting here now, how could you ever be separate from the blooming and burning of the desert? Zen Master Zhuangzi had affinity with Fayan. Once Zhuangzi was appointed as director in the assembly of Fayan. One day, Fayan said, "How many years have you been here?" Zhuangzi replied, "I have already been in the Master's Assembly for 3 years." Fayan said, "You are a student, so why don't you ever ask me about Dharma?" Zhuangzi said, "I dare not deceive the teacher. When I was at King Feng's place, I realized peace and joy." Fayan asked, "Through what words were you able to enter?" Zhuangzi replied, "I once asked King Feng, what is the self of the student?" King Feng says, "The fire boy comes seeking fire." Fayan said, "Good words, only I am afraid that you do not understand them." Zhuangzi said, "The fire boy belongs to fire. Already the fire, but still seeking fire, is just like being self and still seeking self." Fayan exclaimed, "Now I really know that you do not understand. If Buddha Dharma was like that, it would not have lasted till today." Zhuangzi was overwrought and jumped up. Out on the path, he thought, "He is the guiding teacher of 500 people. His pointing out my error must have some good reason." He returned to Fayan's place and did prostrations in repentance. Fayan said, "You should ask the question." Zhuangzi said, "What is the self of the student?" Fayan said, "The fire boy comes seeking fire." Zhuangzi was greatly enlightened. When the fire boy comes seeking fire, what then? To say that the fire boy seeking fire is wrong because the fire boy already has fire is itself wrong. Saying that the fire boy is a good boy because he seeks fire whenever he can, that the fire boy was fired up about fire, that too is wrong. Saying that fire belongs to everyone and the fire boy is a pointless relic is also wrong. We are entirely the fire boy. and the fire is the entirety of the way. The fire boy comes seeking fire. Is there a problem to be solved? Touching and turning away are both wrong, for it is like a mass of fire. The Buddha way is unattainable. I vow to attain it. Must we create something out of that? Why not just bear witness to our own confusion about attainability, about becoming a Buddha? Full stop. Just bear witness. Fully seeing our own anxiety about becoming a Buddha, about measuring up, about attaining the way, we attain the way. The desert blooms and burns all at once. Those who know there is mind are drowning common people. Those that say there is not mind are deluded heretics. To think that there is either something or nothing is the result of delusion. To seek is to be misled. Without seeking, there can be no gain. Cast away whatever you cling to immediately. Do you burn to attain something? Ordinary mind is the way. Mind is Buddha. No mind, no Buddha. Neither mind nor Buddha. Neither the wind nor the flag. If you vow to direct yourself toward the Buddha way, you're immediately mountains and rivers away from the way. Just climb on the wheelchair, go for a spin, and see what happens. I'll close with a verse by Mumon. Rio cited this verse in his talk on Thursday, and I highly recommend you listen to his talk. It goes like this. Hundreds of flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, and snow in winter. If there is no vain cloud in your mind, for you, it is a good season.